Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast, originally recorded in 1992, features the late Aaron Woldovsky, Professor of Political Science and Public Policy, and Dr. Bruce Ames, Professor Emeritus of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology, both at UC Berkeley. We hope you enjoyed today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
I'm Bruce Ames. I'm Professor of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology at UC Berkeley, and I'm talking to Aaron Woldovsky, who's a professor of political science. Normally, biochemists and political scientists don't talk to each other that much, but Aaron's been very interested in risk and why people worry about some risks rather than other risks, and has written books on this, and I've gotten very interested in the causes of cancer and the causes of aging, and that's gotten me very interested in all the environmental movement and toxic chemicals in the water, and are they really doing anything? So we meet and talk fairly often. So,
Bruce asked me before, what was the best and the worst ideas I have had? One tends to suppress the worst ones. I suppose that's why there's no journal of negative results. But I think the best ones I have had have come from asking better questions. Asking a good question is a long way toward finding some answer. For instance, in the risk field that we share, when I first became aware that there was such a problem out there, is technology our friend, or as it has become suddenly our enemy and is doing terrible things to the human body and the natural environment, it was a while before I started to ask a question so obvious nobody had actually thought to ask it before, namely, were human beings healthier or sicker in the United States, say, and in industrial countries than they were before? And I got a hold of an information please almanac, and I looked for the United States, and would you believe it, decade by decade, there were just incredible improvements. I looked at injury rates and accident rates, the same.
Yeah, if you look at life expectancy in the U.S., it goes up every year. Some of that's due to infant mortality, but life expectancy just keeps on going up in the U.S.
And it's also true for racial minorities. Right. They are not doing as well as Caucasians. Right. But if you compare to their prior rates, say 1900, but decade by decade, so everywhere, it makes a big difference. If you ask how come we're getting sicker and sicker, contrary to the evidence, or if you ask, as I started to do, what are we doing? What is there in our political and economic and scientific and technological systems that, by and large, is enabling people to live longer and to enjoy life and to be in better condition at various ages than they were before? That question takes you in a completely different direction than asking why the youth of America are dropping like flies.
Yeah, I agree. In science too, asking the right question is three quarters of the battle, because it's thinking through what, how to formulate a problem and what is the key question to ask to solve a problem. And then finding the answer sometimes is straightforward and sometimes it isn't, but it's formulating how to look at it. I can give an example of that. I've been interested in animal cancer tests. And so animal cancer tests are done at the maximum tolerated dose. You find, take a chemical, you feed it to a rat every day of its lifetime at just under the level that'll kill it. And then people were doing this and they thought, we're going to identify carcinogens and we'll eliminate carcinogens in the human environment. Carcinogens are very few, and we'll test them in this way. And that was a reasonable idea when people started. Now, they started using these enormous doses for various reasons I won't go into. But anyway, that all the tests are done that way. Now, what are they testing are synthetic industrial chemicals, because we know that workers got cancer from high doses of beta-naphthalene or industrial chemicals last century. And the workers were actually getting enormous doses. And so people started testing these things in rats, and half of them came out positive. Now, that was sort of a shock to people because they expected carcinogen to be rare, but at these high doses, half of them come out positive. Now, there's an obvious question to ask about all of that, and somehow it wasn't asked, and that is, what about natural chemicals? And the idea was out in certain circles, well, if it's man-made, it's a time bomb waiting to explode. And if it's natural, we can forget about it because nature's benign. And it turns out it's not true. Every chemical is toxic at some level. You can kill yourself with salt or sugar or whatever. The caffeine in your coffee, 20 times or so the level that you get in a single cup of coffee will kill you. So every chemical is toxic at some level, and there's all our defenses handle natural and synthetic in the same way, and they're all inducible. You make more of the defenses when you have damage. So all my training in toxicology said this whole idea that if it's man-made, it's bad, and we should go after a part per billion or something, just didn't smell right. So we decided to ask, what were the natural chemicals in the world, and how do those come out?
Yeah, that's a great example. Let me give one from the area of social policy that goes directly at the question of expectations. Mm-hmm. Up through some significant part of the 1960s, the general expectation, not only among students of policy, but among practitioners, was that it was pretty easy to make policies work. You didn't need the resources and the determination, but if the will and the money were there, you could do it. In studying what was going on in the city of Oakland, gradually it began to, a certain anomaly began to bother me, namely that when I went to Washington, they kept asking about Oakland as if it were some foreign city. What is actually happening there? And why is it that certain employment programs, for example, that we think really ought to work, dissipate, and we can't find evidence that they have been helpful? This led me to formulate not so much a question, but an expectation. Namely, maybe it's hard to make programs work. Now, it turned out, when you did a microanalysis of each step, that you needed like something like 70 to 80 clearances by different agencies. And if you just were to say, well, each clearance, you gave it a 99% chance of going through. It turned out by the time you were through 14 clearances, your chances of getting the programmatic effect that you want was less than half. And of course, by 70 times, it was a very low figure indeed. That finding, which led to the formation of a kind of subfield called implementation, is not possible to imagine if you think our problem is that things really ought to work well and that something is terribly wrong if they don't. Whereas if you turn it around and say, it's really hard to make things happen, you get a much clearer view.
Well, a lot is people building castles on wrong assumptions, and that happens all the time. So kicking your assumptions all the time is a test of a good scientist. When a fact comes up and it doesn't seem to fit in, why doesn't it fit in? Is there some other way of looking at it that would make it fit in? And if there's a fact that's really true, sometimes facts aren't true, and you don't understand it, that often makes you think of a much better way of explaining everything, because it keeps on bothering you, and you keep on turning, is that assumption wrong?
And of course, one reason that people don't often ask better questions or wait or it takes a long time is that we're all subject to being in the same intellectual or mental groove. So that when everybody else is thinking differently, then somebody might look askance at you. I have a question. I was going to ask you where the idea came from that maybe instead of very tiny amounts of chemicals giving people cancer or otherwise harming them, which seems extremely unlikely, you got the idea that maybe these poor little rodents were being poisoned, so that the cancers were kind of like an afterthought.
So as I mentioned before, we started thinking about what about all the natural chemicals in the world? It just didn't seem right to my intuition that those weren't equally dangerous to the synthetic. And so we started looking in plants. Now, everybody was worried about pesticides, synthetic pesticides, but in fact, 99.99% of the pesticides are natural, because every plant is filled with 50 or 100 chemicals to kill off the fungi and the insects, and they're much better chemists than Dow and Monsanto, and they've been at it a long time. And so I call these nature's pesticides. So we did a big review, Lois Gold and I, and tried to add up how much do we eat in a day, what's the variety of these things. It was all in the scientific literature, but it was people who were looking at that were organic chemists who were fishing chemicals out of plants, or people in the plant, the carcinogenesis people weren't looking at it. But in fact, 72 or something like that of these natural pesticides been tested in animal cancer tests, about half of them came out positive. And it was 99.99% natural. So every item in your supermarket has carcinogens as defined by these high-dose rodent tests. And then we started looking at burnt material. You think of burnt material, think of cooking your food. You get more burnt material than a smoker gets. Look in a cup of coffee, all that burnt material. You look in a cup of coffee, and they've described over 1,000 chemicals in a cup of coffee. And again, maybe 25 of them have been tested, half of them are carcinogens. So there are already more carcinogens in a cup of coffee known, with 1,000 chemicals left to test, than pesticide residues you get in a year. So something's wrong. And so we started thinking, why are so many chemicals coming out positive in animal cancer tests? So I knew something is wrong there. And that's what got us thinking about mechanism and reevaluating mechanism.
Okay. Right. Yeah. This has given me, right. Your answer has given me right. Some time to think of a couple of real bad choices I have made. One of them has to do with the Vietnam War. The argument of the opponents of the war, in large part in those days, though we have forgotten, was that this was an indigenous struggle in the South, and that the North really had nothing to do with it. This was not a case of the South being invaded by the North, but of the United States supporting a corrupt and undemocratic regime in the South against these lovely indigenous forces that wanted to be free. I knew then from various evidences that their accusation was wrong, and everything we have known since demonstrates that in this respect, I was correct. I mean by that the leaders of the North have written their memoirs, and now they want to get credit for what they did. So they tell you how they kept sending people and material and arms into the South. But I made then, I think, a crucial error, which I have tried not to repeat. And it goes like this. If the arguments contrary to your position are foolish or even obviously wrong, that doesn't mean it's obviously true that the opposite is right. I should have thought not so much about what galled me, namely these funny arguments about this being indigenous, and I should have thought more about what made sense for American foreign policy. So I've tried now to rectify that error. And just another brief one. When I started to go into political cultural analysis here, I took immediately a wrong turn, which was where the whole literature was, which is ask, how does culture influence A, B, C, and D? How does culture influence economic development, political democracy, and so on? Now, it's not that I've gone away so much from that question, as it left a tremendous hole in the argument, because culture then became the great uncaused cause. Culture caused everything, and nothing caused culture. And that's why I became interested in the work of a great anthropologist, namely Mary Douglas, because she was interested in not only the question, how do people go about getting what they want from the government or the economy, but why do they want what they want in the first place? And what I discovered then was that if you did it her way, you generated a lot of falsifiable propositions. To give a contemporary analogy in just a few seconds, one of the frustrating aspects of the arguments in favor of global warming being very large and very dangerous is that there's no way to refute it. When you ask it to retrodict back into the past, it predicts twice as much warming as has actually occurred. That's not so good. If you ask, what about regional effects, they say the models are too gross. if you say, what about next month or next year or the next few years, they say the models are too imprecise. So all you can get is prediction somewhere 20 to 30 years out. Well, you could think that you found everybody's childhood dream, an irrefutable hypothesis. But I discovered an older wisdom, again with the culture business, that if you have something that's always true, it's worthless. And so I think here are two cases where both, one for public policy and one for, you might think of as scientific direction, that I lost some time and misled myself and perhaps other people. Can you think of any wrong starts?
I can. When in the early days of my work in this area, in the area of carcinogenesis, I was interested in mutagens, chemicals that damage the DNA. And all my intuition said mutagens ought to be carcinogens because each cell is programmed when to grow and when not to grow. And you mutate the DNA and you can overrule it. And that was an old idea, but it sort of fell into disrepute. And so we started showing we could detect carcinogens as mutagens in our bacterial system. And I was fighting lots of fights to say carcinogens are really working as mutagens. And we showed some high percentage of carcinogens were mutagens. And in retrospect, I was stupid in that, but in hindsight, you always think you're stupid because it's hard to see everything. But there were some carcinogens that clearly didn't seem to be mutagens. But one could always think, well, maybe under some conditions they were mutagens. And in the early days, we showed maybe 80% or so of carcinogen showed up as mutagens. But then, and people started arguing, well, there are other ways of doing cancer, making cancer besides mutagens. And I didn't see any way that that could be, and I kind of dismissed it intellectually. But then, as I mentioned, when we started realizing that half of all chemicals, half of natural chemicals, are coming out positive in animal cancer tests, then one needs to rethink it. And in a way, it was obvious all the time. You can damage the DNA, but that's not a mutation. The mutation occurs when the cell divides. So cell division has to be part of mutagenesis, and mutagenesis is part of carcinogenesis. So cell division rates are very important. And if you start killing cells, then you get a lot of extra cell division. And people weren't measuring that in high-dose animal cancer tests. And more, I think the evidence is coming from every direction that what high-dose animal cancer tests are doing is they're killing cells, you're getting cell division, or they're interfering with cell-cell communication, so you get cell division. And that's a terribly important factor, and it's a high-dose-only factor. So something like saccharin is a carcinogen at high doses, but there's no risk at all at low doses. And something that's a mutagen is also killing cells at high doses, so you get big multipliers. So the risk everybody tells you is probably 1,000 times below the risk that's really there when you get to low doses, or even zero risk at low doses. So, but
that's no wonder then. That's a very sophisticated idea.
Well, in hindsight, it's obvious. And I just keep on kicking myself, why didn't I see that right then and there and think about these complexities? But sometimes you're forced into changing the way you're thinking when some uncomfortable fact comes up and you can't throw it out and you have to deal with it.
Right. Yes. That's a lovely explanation. I'm thinking this week, I'm involved last week and this week in a controversy where I am this unknown person who is reported in the newspapers, I have about 10 clippings now, as the idiot author of some work that the Office of Management and Budget has used to question some regulations. Mm-hmm. This work called Searching for Safety, basically...
Yeah, I read your book. I really enjoyed that.
Yes, thank you. But it basically says that when you spend a lot of money to ward off some danger, say from some occupational exposure, and you should always be careful with occupational exposures, if you spend enough, you reduce people's standard of living. And the standard of living is so closely connected to people's health that we are in danger of making ourselves poorer and sicker in the name of health. Well, I have a list of adjectives as to how dumb this thought is that would go quite a long way. I believe this is happening because the term risk itself, for example, has become converted into a purely negative one. You don't think of risks as the other sides of opportunities, but simply as negative effects of technology. The whole debate is about how we should do good things, protect people. No congressman is going to go to her or his constituents and say, look, I let so many of you die this week, right? They want everybody to live. And therefore, if somebody says that there is something in the world that isn't perfect, namely diminishing risk activities, they say there's something wrong. But consider an aphorism that environmentalists like. No act does only one thing. But that is appropriate here too. You may have a measure designed to increase safety that in fact diminishes it. And the idea that it's only money would suggest that we could spend infinite amounts per hypothetical life saved. Whereas if you have to be concerned that yes, you might alleviate some distress here, but the same actions might increase it there, it's a much more complex balancing act. Which view will prevail? I have just, in 5 seconds, two views. Politically, my opponents will prevail. 20 years from now, when it no longer matters, it will become obvious that trying to remove tiny, tiny, teeny amounts of stuff from anything is more harmful than helpful. But as of this moment, there are people on many sides.
Let me give you an example of that. So I've been saying that synthetic pesticide residues are so tiny compared to anything else. As I say, a cup of coffee has more carcinogen than pesticide residues you get in a year. That to spend your time in scaring the public about it hurts in lots of ways. One is the one way you can really lower your cancer rate, other than giving up smoking, which is about a third of cancer, is to eat more fruits and vegetables. You make fruits and vegetables more expensive, you increase cancer rates, you make fruits and vegetables cheaper, you decrease cancer rates because poor people buy more fruits and vegetables when they're cheaper. Well, EPA is a very efficient organization for making fruits and vegetables more expensive, but that never gets into the equation, and that's a big factor. The other thing is if you scare the public about these tiny hypothetical risks all the time, they don't know what's important. Minor risks drive out big risks because public gets confused. So I agree with you perfectly that if people have more money and a bigger salary, that's the best thing you can do for health. They can change the tires in their car more often. They can buy their fruits and vegetables. They can do all sorts of things. Health is a good they buy too.
Right. Think of it. Health might have some material base rather than a purely ethereal one. I have a question for you that I have been wondering about. In one way, science pays off for new ideas. And people, you can see this tremendous scramble for I invented it first.
Right.
On the other hand, the number of scientists who speak out on these environmental matters, when one reads their literature and you see that what they know is directly opposed to what is being done and touted as safe. And yet very, very few say a word. You would think in a field where they wanted some preference for saying something a little different, people would speak up, but I don't find it.
Yeah, well, so it's a question why, and I think about that a lot because I am speaking up and I don't see a lot of support. Yet when you talk to scientists, they say, oh, it's crazy. We know natural chemicals and synthetic chemicals are not fundamentally different. We know these are very tiny amounts. They're not important. Yet every week there's a toxic story and these guys aren't speaking up. Why is that? Well, partly I think it's incentives, that a scientist's incentives are to do more good science. That's what he gets his grant money and all the other things he cares about is the approval of his peers from doing good science. And if you start spending your time talking to reporters, it's time away from that. And the other thing is that people are very specialized. The epidemiologists who study cancer in people, don't know much about animal cancer testing. They couldn't care less. They think they're going to solve it by looking in people directly. And I think they're probably mostly right. The animal cancer test people have a big vested interest now in animal cancer tests are important. And they, in a sense, have intellectual blinders because all their self-interest, they spent their whole lifetime doing high-dose animal cancer tests. They don't want to know that it's not really telling us about what's causing cancer. So anyway, there are various reasons, but it is a little disappointing.
Yeah, but I think
and
the audience
is challenging. It's also challenging what's the conventional wisdom.
Right.
Now, I'm a very, have a long distinguished career in science, and I'm willing to get up and shout. But a young person starting off isn't willing to challenge, might get into trouble.
I just thought it would be useful for those who listen in on this to understand that we both know there's a politics of science. Now, when you say that science corrects its errors, we don't speak that Mr. A or Mr. B or one of us is, quote, wholly objective and so on. Right. We depend on a process for winnowing out the truer from the falser, so to speak. But there are sanctions and penalties. And one reason I think there are not as many new ideas as there might be is it's not a one-way street. If it's purely scientific, one could be wrong. And you spend a number of years following up a false lead. That isn't too wonderful for one's career. But then when a matter becomes politicized, then you can get a lot of backbiting and a lot of barking. If you would say, for example, a Bruce Ames is at the top of his profession, I can tell you, having been president of my political science association, that if you want to feel marginalized in about 5 seconds, all you have to do is say that you don't agree that terrible harm is being done to the environment or that small amounts of trace chemicals or toxic waste dumps are things that serious people ought to worry about, and you'll very quickly discover what it is to be not only unloved, but to be thought to be quaint, ridiculous. And why is this peculiar person saying something that, quote, everybody knows
well,
is false?
Well, the religions that develop, and environmentalism is taking on a religious fervor, and then people don't treat the people who say other things as out of the pale.
Well, you know, I noticed that fundamentalists, generally pretty much pro-scientific, outside of creationism, of course, here. But I take it you mean that it's become a way of life, an ideology, an idea of that the good life is inseparably connected with eating lower on the food chain and consuming less resources and basically moving away from a modern industrial society. Now, if you can persuade people that their waste products are intolerable, then of course they can't continue to do what they do because life is such that every living creature excretes waste. So these quarrels around which people are having ideas of all kinds are part of a basic political struggle of how people ought to live with one another. And we're just caught up in the middle of it.
Yeah. No, I think socialism was the big idea of the last century, and now environmentalism is the big idea of this century. And both have taken on a religious fervor.
And when you have very little people like us confronting a very big idea, then you can figure out what the consequences will be. And if somebody was observing us, they would want to know not why we don't, in a way, go along with this, but why we are taking the trouble to say something different, to stand in the way of this immense steamroller. But then we will hear from the other side that they're the ones who are oppressed, suppressed, and depressed here, and that we speak for the establishment, but I raise my hand in scout's honor and say it's not so.
Maybe that's a good time to finish our discussion.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.